changes, there's levels that are going all over the place. Like, this is going to take a lot of surgery. And the first thing I did was I just started taking some instrumentals from great 90s tracks and put them underneath these acapellas. And within 30 seconds, I knew that it was going to work. Like, as soon as the beat went over the acapellas, it was like, oh, all the transient issues, the places where there's artifact noise, that all gets disguised when drums go on top of the tracks. And I sent Bob a little 30-second snippet of Jay-Z and Big L rhyming over this, and he was like, what? So, and then I was like, okay, now I got to really, yeah, it's been, I haven't sampled tracks and sequenced beats since the 90s. Let's see what happens here.
Yeah.
And I'm a much more confident person now. I think I'm musically much more sophisticated. And of course, we've got, you know, decades of music that's influenced us. I mean, just my mental space is just such a different, it's in such a different place than I was in, you know, 1995, 1996. Yeah. And I'm really pleased with what we created. We can't wait to share it with the world. I think the stuff's available now as we speak.
Yeah.
To even it out. You know, not only did we grab the acapella versions of Big L, Jay-Z, Method Man, Ghostface, and Biggie from our 90s archive, but we also have Nas's Freestyle, Big Pun and Fat Joe, Mobb Deep, Mad Skills with Q-Tip, OC with Pharrell March and Lars Professor doing it on an SP. I mean, on and on and on. So think about the very, you know, like highest level live moments in our radio history, you know, that were featured in our film, Stretching by Beatle Radio to Change Lives. And we're going to release an album of like 20 of these freestyles.
Remastered. And revitalized. And reimagined.
And remixed with, you know, with elements of our band, the M19s. And it kind of just, it's like the best culmination of everything. Cause it's like, we get to celebrate our past without being stuck in it, you know, and we get to introduce people to our band, the M19s, you know, that we released this incredible album with in January titled No Request. The pandemic hit. We had a whole tour, you know, booking agent, the whole thing completely squashed, you know, and so the album kind of got derailed and didn't get the attention that I think we could have garnered had we been out there, like, you know, doing interviews locally and getting people hyped. I mean, you know, our first show was at the Kennedy Center. Mm-hmm. Our first show was at the Kennedy Center, right. And it sold out two shows. And then we did the Gramercy Theater in New York City. So, you know, we're really excited about what we're doing now. You know, 2020, we're excited about celebrating our 30th anniversary. And then we got the Apple Music, you know, Hits radio show. So it's like me and Stretch are like, yo, we're pumping it. Like, you know, we talk every single day, multiple times a day, not just about like, yo, what'd you eat? Like, yo, did you respond to the PR? Did you, you know, we got this interview tomorrow. Yo, we got to submit the remix. Oh, it's dropping on, you know, it's like, whoa, like, you know, it's a crazy time for us in the most beautiful and invited way.
That's beautiful. Now, shout out to Funkmaster Flex. I don't know if y'all know this, but I started my career working with Flex and carrying crates and
You told me in Brazil on the beach.
That's right.
Remember that day?
Yeah. Wait, whoa. Brazil on the beach. Where was I?
Yeah, we had a gig. Bobito gave me 10
years ago.
And when we was in Rio de Janeiro, that I still use to this day. No forgive action is the phrase that you gave me. Because we were talking about like stepping on our shoes and whatnot. He was like, that's no forgive action, B.
Did a Brazilian step on your shoes?
What shoes were you wearing?
Bob had on some like Air Force ones on the beach. I was just like, that's a New York shit.
With the toes cut out? Air Force One sandals?
He was just stomping in his Air Force Ones.
Yo, I've never been to Brazil.
Get the stomping in my Air Force.
I'm tight about that.
We got to schedule that back up after this COVID lockdown.
If anyone in Brazil is listening, I want to come down and DJ with Bob.
That's right.
Let's go.
I bring up Flex.
With Talib.
Yeah, I would love to DJ with y'all. But I bring up Flex because he gave you that wonderful advice, and I used to work with him. And Flex called me recently, and he expressed regret at not playing certain records at the height of his career. He was like, you know, when I was, you know, I came up under Marley Marl, and I was I was trying to make DJing big for everybody. I was trying to make DJing big for the other DJs, for the culture. And so I was trying to play big records, big hits, and that's the mentality I was in. And so, you know, there's records that would come out from you and Black Thought and other artists that people would be like, this is real hip hop, this is real hip hop. But I didn't play these records. I was in a different phase. Now, listeners to the show, you know, I remember I'll be completely frank and completely straight up. There was a time when Stretch, you as a DJ, went very much into this like sort of grimy street life rap bag. And so for me, as an artist coming up in that time, I was starting to get my name known. I knew that if Bobbito was spinning, I could more likely hear a Talib Kweli record or somebody like a Lyrical Miracle rapper record from a Bob set than from a Stretch set. And so I kind of want to know for both of y'all, what made you go into that zone at that time in your life? And Bob, what was happening in your life where you're like, I'm trying to move away from that and try to play more sort of, I won't say abstract or alternative, but things that in your mind were more hip hop.
Since Bob got the last word in our film and made me look bad, he can go first.
I mean, I don't think I discounted what Stretch was playing as not hip hop ever, but you know, I was of the mind to provide an alternative to what, I mean, yeah, that's the only way I was going to grab space in the DJ pantheon that I was living in was to play something that was different than everybody else was playing. Cause I wasn't going to outcut Stretch or, you know, Rob Swift. I wasn't going to outblend Rich Medina and Spinna. I wasn't going to have more Rare Records than Kenny Dope or Citizen Kane. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had to find my space. And my space was like, you know, like there's some incredible MCs that, you know, looking back now, like I listen to some of the records that I might have played in 98 and 97 where I'm kind of like, maybe I was paying too much attention to the written and not to the expressed, you know, rhythmic rhymes the as well as the beats. but you know, I don't regret playing any records. I may not have saved them or would play them now, but at the time it felt like they needed to be heard. You know, they felt like they needed to be heard. And I mean, I wouldn't put you in the same space with some of the other artists. Like I could stand by a Reflection Eternal record or a Black Star record or a Talib solo record, you know, 22 years later, like I'm good. But there's other records that I was kind of like, they were just, you know, Stretch would make fun of me. Like the lyrical meter was like too much dipping into the red.
The syllable meter. The syllable meter's in the red.
Yeah, the syllable meter. But you know, I mean, it was what the time was. And, you know, similar to what Flex was saying, you know, I had a voice, right? And I had a big influence on MCs and how they recorded. And I would tell some of them, like, yo, get off your high horse. Like, because you're being repetitive. All you're talking about is whack MCs. New Eureka Post Cafe, every verse was about whack MCs. I'm not whack.
The ubiquitous whack MC that we all hate is the bane of our existence as a lyrical.
Yeah, it was just like everybody was being repetitive and people were really not being as original as they thought they were being. Mm. They were being reactionary. It was like everybody was like reacting to, oh, you know, these big suits and our music is getting commercialized. So we're going to keep it real. We're going to keep it extra real. But meanwhile, like people lost like the funk and the dance aspect of independent rap, which was like every independent rap record. If you listen to Me and Stretch Show in the 90s, if you see footage of us in the 90s or 91, people are dancing in our studio.
Y'all dancing.
Yeah. WKCR was like literally like sheets and pillows inside like the size of a bedroom studio. Right. You know, it was a party, you know, and that's because all the independent rap records that Stretch was championing were danceable. You know, he could play them in a club or he could play them on the radio. It was no different. That divide became very, very wide by 97, 98, where like any indie hip hop record was like not danceable at all. It was like 82 BPMs and just super lyrical.
Super slow and to fit all the syllables.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You're right. It was. And so, you know, between my label, I was putting out records like that. I was playing records like that. You know, I was putting MCs on. Yeah, you know, I had the open mics at New Eureka Poets Cafe. I was hosting Lyricist Lounge. So I was like, you know, very much like this sort of, I became like this sort of Pied Piper for like ultra lyrical MCs, which I feel good about. But, you know, I was advocating just the same for, you know, there was a record. I played on Mia Shirt's IG Live like a couple of weeks ago. I don't remember the name of the artist right now, but the dude wasn't ultra lyrical. It was like a dope ass record that could have came out in 87 just the same. And I was championing that record. And there were other records that were like that, that, you know, but I probably, you know, if I knew Stretch was going to play it, I didn't feel like I need to play it.
Okay.
So
I think the idea that Bob was just playing like super lyrical indie stuff and I was just playing like hard street rap, that's a little bit of a caricature, because I certainly, there were plenty of records that I played that were an exception to that. Just like Bob said, Bob, there are records that, I'm sure there are records even as late as 97 or 98 that I would play, but I'd be like, oh, that's dope. For me, I think, and you know, I say this in our doc, and it's true, I really didn't pay that much attention to lyrics. I was more interested in rhythm and just the overall kind of feel of music. And sometimes I felt like the overly lyrical music felt like it was calling too much attention to the lyrics and to the, to the content of what was being said, rather than how a voice interacts with a beat in kind of a funky syncopated way. And I felt like just a lot of like the, yeah, a lot of the stuff that I just liked on a musical level was harder. It was, you know, more like you said, like street rap. And you know, there are other things going on in my life that kind of, sorry, my dog is wilding, that coincided with that. I mean, I had a really strong friendship with Tragedy, and that was kind of my link to a lot of the Queensbridge guys. Even,
right,
of course, you know, we go back, you know, with P and Hav, even before they were Mobb Deep. You know, I was always kind of, I always got a lot of love in the Bridge because of my support for the music that came out of it. I think that's automatically happened because I revered, you know, the sort of the mythical importance of the Bridge and Marley Marl and et cetera, which was only consolidated by the emergence of a young Nasty Nas. I mean, I'd go to Queensbridge to visit Traj or Havoc, and yo, not for nothing, like I'd go on the basketball court as the sun was going down and like 30 kids would come up to talk to me. It was amazing. And you know, that was the same time when you know, they would be, you know, they'd just tell me like, yo, such and such, they won't even come out here. You would, that's amazing. Like, yo, and it was just, you know, again, that goes back to like my father, right? Like,
right,
like
yeah, right.
I'm going to Queensbridge. Right. Why wouldn't I go to Queensbridge? Right. I've been like, first of all, like I grew up, like you could practically see Queensbridge from where I grew up on the East Side, and the music that came out of there, Marley Marl and I, we share a birthday. I got to know Marley in the 90s, and he's always super cool with me, which is always super trippy, because when people ask me who your heroes are, I sometimes feel like I don't really have heroes, but
yeah,
Marley Marl would be one of them. So I think that played a role in it. But, you know, there's also another factor, and was this kind of subliminal friction between me and Bob. Like, he knew how to annoy me, and I knew how to annoy him. And we were being very passive-aggressive through the music, because, you know, until Bob brought it up at Hot 97, was like, yo, my man, like, neither of us are happy with this. Should we just go separate ways? There was a long time before that when we weren't addressing it. And I think because both of us could not accept the fact in some way that things had really changed, because what we had prior to them changing was so special, and to acknowledge it and to really kind of act on it, I think was, I don't know, scary, sad, whatever. So we, you know, maybe we were thinking like, this might pass, you know, maybe the music will get like incredible again, and like hip hop will save the day. You know, so Yeah, I enjoy playing records that Bob would be like inside. Oh my God, I hate this song. Why is he playing it? I'd be like, yeah, I'm gonna double up the top for 3 minutes. And I think Bob, you know, he knew what would get under my skin. And Bob, some of Bob's antics on the mic, he knew would annoy me and would do it gleefully. So there was that aspect as well. And then for me, like, you know, I think both Bob and I both came to a point when we were like, you know what? The music that's coming out, it's just not speaking to me in a way that it did when we first got on the radio. And maybe this doing the radio isn't for us right now. Maybe, you know, someone else that is really, really feeling it would be better suited to doing this. And that's a very mature conclusion to come to, because it's hard to give up radio in New York. I mean, how many people want to be on the radio in New York and don't get a chance? And here we are, mature enough to accept that this isn't for us right now. Right. So let's step away. I mean, I'll be honest, like, I was struggling with being on Hot 97. I wasn't enjoying it, but in all honesty, I didn't let it go. I was canned. But I think me being canned was in response to me clearly just going through the motions and just showing up and not really being that into it. But KCR is really the more important thing for us to talk about, because we're here together. You know, in about 98, that's when I tapped out. And, you know, I wasn't even exploring music. I wasn't looking for things. I wasn't getting records. It's funny now, I'll come across records online, on Discogs, on YouTube or whatever, looking at playlists from DJs and listening to things and be like, oh, that's amazing. What is that? Like, oh, that came out in 99. That came out in 98. I never got that record. Now maybe, you know, there's a cycle that goes here. Like, if I'm not playing it, then why is a independent operation that's got to spend real money on getting the records pressed, why are they going to even bring it to me if I'm not going to play it? And so I missed out on a lot of music that I think would have been, would have given me the satisfaction of playing music that people need to hear that I just wasn't aware of back then. And certainly, you know, hindsight is 2020. I think both of us would have done things differently. I'm just proud of the fact that, you know, for a good 7 years, you know, I gave it my all. And then moonwalked out the picture.
Yeah, I want to go back. So this is the Eric Payday record called Melanie that I was championing back then. I don't know any other DJs that were playing it. And it even goes back to the Apple Music Hits question where, you know, I will play this on Stretching Bobbito Radio on Apple Music Hits. I doubt it's in their universe. And I hope that maybe they like, wow, this is a cool song. Let's figure out who's the rights owner, and they, you know, put it up. And then while I was looking for this record, because it was, I just came across Talib Kweli, Get By.
Is that a white label? 12-inch. Get By?
Yeah. And then I got the, you know, this. I know Black Star is about to drop with new music.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came across my High Tech Technology record. And then my other, I think Get By is like your greatest work.
Yes.
Ever. It's one of my favorite hip hop records, period. But Respiration as well. I just came across this 12-inch is another, like, yes, really, really phenomenal record.
Yeah, those pieces of vinyl are the foundation of my career.
Yeah.
In your catalog, yeah. So yeah. Anyway, I just figured I'd just big you up. You amazing, know, these are all records amazing that I was playing.
Nas said in Radio That Changed Lives that he made Illmatic with the Stretch and Bob audience in mind. Can you break down exactly what that means to you? And I know it's easy to be biased, but where does that album fall on your app on the greats?
I think he said, I wrote most of my album listening to your show.
If there's ever a compliment from an MC about our radio show, I think that would be
Yeah. That's a big one.
That's a big one.
Because that album is seen as, you know, that album has left, it's firmly planted in the world of hip hop. When you talk about the greatest albums of the world from any genre of music, Illmatic is a strong contender for the top of that category, the top 10, top 20, top 30 greatest albums ever made of any genre. And for him to be like, I made that album while I was listening to Stretch and Bob. It's a lot. It speaks a lot to the mentality of what he was trying to convey. Because everybody in hip hop thinks of Nas as being the sort of the poet who was in the hood in uncomfortable, unfortunate circumstances, who was sitting by his window and writing what people was going through. And even Nas raps about his mother had the plates for everybody. People in the projects felt comfortable coming over his house, but it didn't stop him from getting involved in the shenanigans. And the Stretch and Bob show was, to me, when Nas made that statement, Nas saying, there's something bigger out there. There's something more than what I'm seeing in this six block Queensbridge radius. And this radio show that I have to like get struggle to get on the right dial, you know, to get the FM signal, this radio show that I'm struggling to get. This is showing me that there's another world out there. Mm. You know, I don't know if I ever told y'all the story about how me and High Tech almost beat up a guy because I was trying to listen to y'all were going to play the Fortify Live or something. Y'all going to play like 2000 seasons of Fortify Live. Me and High Tech had landed from Japan because we had started touring by this time and landed at JFK. There was a guy, I think he was Russian. Excuse me. And you know, when you land in JFK, they have the signs in New York where they say, do not get in a car with someone who's not a cab driver. Yeah. Well, this story is why they have these signs, right? So the guy was like, for $20, I'll bring you to Brooklyn. I was like, $20, that was a cheap price even back then to come from the airport. He drove us and I was leaning over the partition to try to get 89.9 on the radio. And I was just getting static. And our tech, who's from Cincinnati, was like, yo, we going the wrong way. I was so focused on trying to, because I didn't want to miss y'all playing the record. I was so focused on trying to get the radio station that I just missed High Tech. I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm from Brooklyn. You from Cincinnati. You don't know. And the guy stopped at a bodega. And I was like, why are you stopping? He's like, I got to go grab some. That was weird. He ran into a bodega. And it was like in Brownsville, which was coming to where I was living in Flatbush. You had to go out of your way to get to Brownsville from the airport. And I was like, yo, why are you even? Well, maybe we was in East New York. It was so one of the neighborhoods we had to go out the way. And the guy got in the car and I'm still trying to figure out the radio situation. And the cab driver bent over and tried to smoke crack while he was driving.
Oh my God.
So what that meant was because when I gave him that $20, that's when I realized that drug addiction is a sickness. It's a sickness. Because when I put that $20 in that man's hands, he could have easily dropped us off and then gotten his fix. But the moment that 20 hit his hands, he drove straight to the crack spot and was trying to smoke while driving secretly. And me and High Tech got frustrated and furious. And I remember kicking the back of the seat and like, pull the fucking car over right the fuck now. And we were on Eastern Parkway. I opened up the door. We had the doors open so we could stop. We stopped and me and High Tech chased him around the car for like 3 minutes, chasing this guy around the car. The police showed up. We told our side of the story. He told his side of the story. The cop was like, that's between y'all. I don't know to do with this. Cop left.
Oh, my goodness.
You know what I'm saying? I was like, yo, he stole our money. He won't give me the money back. The guy was like, y'all ain't give me no money. Y'all give me $20. I'm like, I gave you $20. You bought some crack. Yo, all because I wanted to get my record to Stretch and Ran, Talib.
Yo, that is the
craziest crazy.
We've heard crazy stories. That is the
I didn't even remember that story until just now. I didn't even have it in my notes to bring it up. I totally forgot about that story until this moment. Right,
I've got a great Stretch and Bob story that I learned yesterday.
Okay,
so we put out a call to our listeners and our followers to submit. Audio that we could then play on the radio. So it could be a shout out, it could be a Stretch and Bob story, whatever. We need a drop from you. And and if you could ask Dave to do one as well, that'd be incredible.
Okay, yeah.
But so this guy said, yo, he said, Stretch and Bob, you guys are responsible for me being with my wife and because of that for being the father to my children. And I want to tell you how. He's at college in New Jersey at Rutgers. in his dorm, he doesn't get the station well. He knew this. He knew a young woman in another dorm, and they got the station.
All these stories, by the way, are because we couldn't get the good signal with the station.
Yeah, yeah. She listened to our radio show, so he would go over there basically every Thursday night, and they fell in love, got married. The way he tells a story is so sweet, Bob. It's in the Dropbox folder.
That's beautiful. Bob is crying.
Yeah. No, it really. I'm not doing it justice the way I'm telling it because it didn't happen to me. But it's a very sweet story. No crack involved.
I was waiting for the crack part, to be honest.
Just ask crack.
They fell in love and then they did crack.
Now, one of my favorite parts of the movie, the Radio Changed Lives movie, is I must have fell out on the floor when this happened. When Bobito shows up to Jay-Z with the bag full of the tapes, and Jay-Z's like, why you got all them tapes? You carry that around in a bag? And I just was like, yo, Jay-Z was so shocked that people carry things in bags. I was like, yo, it's crazy. I was like, he's been rich for a long fucking time. He's like, yo, wait a second. So you have a bag that you carry tapes in? And then when he's, this is classic Jay-Z that you caught on film. Because Jay-Z is very, very arrogant rapper. It's part of his personality. And as you're playing him the freestyle, and he's listening to tape, and he does, you know, he does that Jay-Z nod, that Jay-Z.
He goes,
and he's like, pretty good, Jay-Z.
He takes the headphones off. Pretty good verses. Pretty good.
Pretty good verses, Jay-Z.
So funny.
Like, yo, he's got a different voice to talk to him, to talk about good. Himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty good. Yeah, it's fucking hilarious. Was it surreal to see him go back to that sort of innocent place before he was Jay-Z the billionaire?
I mean, I think from a director standpoint, you know, that moment exceeded all expectations because to give you background, I mean, it took 18 months to book Jay to get him on camera, you know, and that's exactly the amount of time that it took us to produce the film. Like we conceived the film in January 2014 and we had to put it out before October 2015, because that was our 25th anniversary.
We
interviewed Jay-Z.
Peep it. Like, I think like 6 weeks, maybe 4 weeks before locking picture, we did not have Jay-Z. We did not have Nas. We didn't have Buster.
Eminem.
And we didn't Eminem, Royce. When we didn't have Be Real. I mean, like, the last month, we were shaking and baking crazy. Yeah.
So that's, you know, first, the film was incredible without Jay-Z, Nas, and Busta, Eminem, and Be Real. And then when we got them in the final weeks before we locked picture, the film went like an extra super duty level. But truth be told, like when we got to Jay's office, it was similar to you with Lil' Kim. Like they were like, yo, you got 10 minutes with Jay. That is it. We can have three people in the room. And we were like, yo, this is a proper like film that's going to be like broadcast internationally, like theaters, everything. Like, you know, we need, you know, audio, we need B-roll, we need, you know, like camera setup, you know, we can't just come in there with three. So like, it was a lot to finally get him there. And then he walks in and he sat with us for like 45, 50 minutes. Like I hadn't seen Jay-Z since February 25th, 1995,
right,
when he came up with Big L. Like that was the last time I saw dude. It'd been 20 years. So, you know, and then for him to receive us the way he did and for him to get into the interview the way he did. But, you know, it was very calculated on our parts. Like me and Stretch, you know, had the idea to present people with not just a freestyle digital, no, like cassette tactile experience. Like Nas didn't even remember how to do rewinds on a Walkman when we gave him the down. I don't think that made the film, but he was having problems like pressing the buttons
to rewind. In the Jay-Z Nas Walkman battle, Jay-Z is the victor. Jay-Z he grabbed it.
Jay-Z was nice with the Walkman.
He put it in. It was it was fluid. Yeah. And Nas was like, what's going on here? What is this? What do I do with these two objects?
But Jay was bugging that I still had cassettes, you know, and I mean, you know, as often people do, but I'm an analog dude, you know, like I love my cassettes and, you know, it was a win for us to have people transport to their childhood and their youth by giving them a cassette of their own voice, you know, some of which, you know, some of the freestyles that we played for people in a film, they didn't even remember doing them. They were right. like, wait, I did this? Like, wait, right. what verse is this? You know?
Yeah,
there were verses that would never made their album, so they forgot about them, you know?
Fat Joe was tripping off the pun.
Yeah, Fat Joe started crying.
He started crying, yeah.
He started crying, yeah. I've heard that.
It was incredible to see people. It's like getting into a time machine and going back into a moment when the craft just meant so much to them, and finally they got this opportunity to do what they've been working so hard at for years and share that with the tri-state area.
And to bring it forward to 2020, like when people hear what we did to these classic freestyles, like it's been unthinkable to hear these freestyles with different music underneath it.
Yeah.
It's like someone handed us Stevie Wonder Intervisions multi-tracks, you know, and we're like, do whatever you want with them. It's like having the acapella version of Big L and Jay-Z. We also got music videos too. Like the same dude who was art director for Stretch and Bobbito, Radio That Changed Lives, and my last film, Rock Rebel 45s, directed and art directed the Big L Jay-Z music video as well as the Biggie video. Mm-hmm. And you want to really talk about surprises. Like, no one's really heard the Biggie freestyle from our radio show. We only did like a small excerpt in our film because of fair use laws. But we have officially licensed everything from the Wallace family. We have the rights to it. And, you know, when it gets streamed, you know, like money will go into the Wallace family's, you know, pockets.
Y'all better pay Big Mama for using his lyrics. Pay Big Mama for using his lyrics.
So it's wonderful for us to you know, to do this, because like all the, you know, how many people have heard the Big L Jay-Z freestyle since it was released, and Big L's family has never received a penny for it. You know, I mean, it's pushed his name, and hopefully it's pushed his released material, but now it's like the Big L Jay-Z freestyle, the Big L's family will monetize that finally.
Well, luckily with the way that, with the way streaming is set up, they'll make at least $500.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
right.
Yeah, go out and download the record like Tyler was saying, and we're going to release 7 inches of all these records, you know, 7-inch box sets, you know, 12 inches, CDs, cassettes, all that. So that's all forthcoming.
Word
up.
You were just talking about Fat Joe, and in your Radio That Changed Lives, he was talking about how you guys gave exposure to making millions. Did it ever make things tough or frustrating to see people getting rich off the platform that you created? And are there certain rappers who recognize that and send you like really nice bottles of wines out of the blue or anything?
Jay-Z does owe me a bottle of champagne. Because when we got on Hot 97, he said that he had one for me, and I never got that bottle. But
Jay-Z, come on now.
I didn't remind him.
Jay-Z found out Cristal was racist, so he stopped dealing with that.
Oh, he said it again. What?
Jay-Z found out Cristal was racist, so he's like, I can't give Stretch a bottle of Cristal. You got a bottle of Ace of Spades coming for you, I'm sure.
But you know, for every Jay-Z or Fugees or DMX or Mobb Deep, there are 30 incredible artists that didn't get rich, that some of them never even had careers, you know, artists that we you know, really you know, thought would. So no, that never really played a role in what we were doing. We were so focused on the show that if an artist that had come through went on to being huge, it was like, cool. They kind of graduated. It was like, we were like elementary school. They graduated and went on and did their thing. There was always, you know, it was a revolving door. There was always the next coming up. And that's what we were interested in. If an artist that had become really successful wanted to come back, that was amazing. But, you know, we knew what the ecosystem was about. You know, if you have a certain amount of success, you're going to be on MTV, you're going to be on Hot 97, and you're going to be busy doing those things. I mean, our show was not the easiest thing to put on your schedule. It was 1 to 5 in the morning. You know, it was like, this was for the hungry. So if you had a little food in your belly, like You were going to go. You're going to go to the next spot, and we were fine with that, and we were proud to see, you know, artists that we were supporting, you know, years before they came out, get signed and get the accolades and the success that they deserve. That just felt great.
One thing that you know, we did not discuss in our film but that was shared in some of the interviews was how we supported this sort of, and I mentioned it earlier, was like this ecosystem, you know. So you know, Fat Beats as a record shop and an eventual distribution hub for indie hip hop records, you know, wouldn't have caught the fire that it did if it wasn't for our support.
That's right.
And a lot of artists, you know, caught their first gigs overseas because me and Stretch were pivotal in working with promoters. That's you right. know, Mass Influence,
shout High out to and Mass Mighty. Influence.
I mean, you know, we can go on like well, a lot of artists who came to our show, you know, we like them. And then by virtue of that, like, we're able to, I mean, MF Doom, you know, ignited a career 24 years long now based off of the demos that we played back in 96, 97. You know, and so we got the, you know, the thank yous on Redman's album, you know, Fuji's album, but we're like first names and the thank yous and the liner notes, you know, and there were other, you know, many other artists who have thanked us like graciously, but in terms of financial rewards, that's never been what we were in for. And in terms of expectations, I don't think either of us ever, we were happy with people just, you know, showing gratitude. That's all.
Yeah.
And you know, Bob shared how gracious Jay was with his time. I feel like the artists really, they looked out for us, you know, the ones that participated. You know, Bob had established a certain narrative for the film, and we were looking for stories from artists, and not just artists, but artists, listeners, and other people to plug into that narrative. And you know, so we weren't trying to get everybody that was important to the show in the movie. I think some people felt like, oh, how come they didn't include me? It wasn't meant to be. We're going to interview every artist that we liked. It was a specific narrative. And once we achieved that narrative with the artists that availed themselves to us, we were able to wrap the movie. But the ones that did, you know, particularly Eminem, Jay, Nas, Busta, you know, artists of a certain caliber, I mean, they were incredibly generous with their time and with what they said. The sentiment of what they shared was amazing and really moving. But it wasn't filling some kind of void that we felt for not having had the, you know, the recognition or the thanks.
Yeah.
You know, we listen, doing that show was incredibly fun. Like we got so much out of it. Like aside from what it meant for our careers, just doing it was incredible. You know, Bob and I, we didn't come up through like a mentor-mentee system. You know, I wasn't carrying records for a radio DJ and waiting for my chance to get on. We were fans that were sort of catapulted onto this platform that we made the most of, but it never felt like we didn't have one foot inside, but still one foot outside. You know, we were like, it was trippy for us to be in that role. And that was just an incredibly lucky position for us to be in. So we got everything out of it.
But yeah, how does the adage go? The adage is, if you do what you love for a living, you'll never work a day in your life. And I think that y'all exemplify that. Now, me coming from an activist background, one of the most interesting parts of what you said in the film, Bob, was talking about how you found yourself talking to people in jails and how you found yourself talking people out of doing crimes or people who may have just committed a crime. At Stretch, you spoke about going to Queensbridge and feeling the impact of kids coming up to you and being like, yo, no one's ever come out here to see us. How did it feel for y'all to be thrust into the role model position, community leadership positions, when y'all were just trying to spin some jams?
I mean, I accepted it immediately. And you know, I started coaching basketball. People don't know this about me, but I started coaching basketball when I was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Like, why the program director trusted me to lead 11-year-olds. I don't know. I think he just saw in me that I would be able to, you know, be a positive influence and teach them skills. And, you know, so when I became a public figure on a radio, it was a immediate sensibility of like kick in, like, oh, I got a voice now. And plus, I mean, remember, I worked at Def Jam. So, mm-hmm. you know, I worked with Chuck D. Like,
right.
Public Enemy was a group that, you know, to me was larger than life. And then, boom, you know,
you're just supposed, how to, you're supposed to say Public Enemy, Chuck D? Yeah, he's a friend of me.
But, you know, how I said, you know, we had 1 foot in and 1 foot out. It was like when I was working at Def Jam, my foot out was still like kind of in awe of like, you know, someone like Chuck who had such impact on people's mentality, you know, mm-hmm. and their awareness of as people of color, as Black people, as human beings. Right. And so, you know, it was easy for me to step into that space and be like, oh, word, like, I'm not an MC, but I'll handle this. And also for the fact, like, you know, I didn't tout this on the radio, but I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. You know, I was always up there with like really clear, like poignant, conscious. And I had friends who were activists, like, you know, front line, like my peoples were in the National Congress of Puerto Rican Rights. You know, I was like, boys with like Luis Gardana Costa, a former young lord. I wound up coaching for the high school that he was a principal at. So, you know, I'm infusing those sort of like relationships and knowledge into the radio in time. It wasn't like immediate, but as I felt comfortable in my space and as I felt like the audience was able to, you know, accept more than just us playing music. And that's going to happen when Apple Music hits as well. Stretching My Beat the Radio first episode that dropped October 22nd is primarily music. You know, as we go along and we take longer mic breaks and people start trusting us, you know, you're going to hear Stretch's endorsements for local politicians who are running for office. Mm. You know, they're going to hear, you know, my affiliations. I mean, with our band, the M19s, our music video for The Mexican, off our first album, was completely advocating immigration and refugee rights, you know, with footage from a documentary about the passage from Central America to the United States. And, you know, with our upcoming single, Que Bonita Bandera, is celebrating the 125th anniversary of the founding of the Puerto Rican flag, you know, prior to the colonization of the island. You know, and there are lyrics that our band and the featured vocalist are going to be singing at that are going to like blow people's minds. The music video that I directed for that is going to blow people's minds. It's imagery of protest against Ricky Rosselló, the former governor who got ousted. You know, there's footage of the hurricane. There's footage of, you know, all the things that people have endured on the island and throughout the diaspora of Puerto Rico. And so, you know, we constantly, Stretch and I, for 30 years, have been the funny, comical dudes, but similar to having 1 foot in and 1 foot out, we've constantly infused people with knowledge, you know, and right. awareness, and in some cases, you know, plausible steps for action, you know, through our various platforms. And we did that with NPR. We're going to do that with Apple Music Hits. And, you know, we're going to continue to do that with our music releases. You know, with the archival releases, maybe not so much, you know, because it's of the era. We want to capture the era. So, you know, me and Stretch talked at length, like, do we keep these lyrics that were okay at the time, but the language that we have in 2020, they're kind of unacceptable. You know, there's a lot of back and forth, you know, because not everybody was politically correct as MCs right. in the 90s. And we're grabbing that and, you know, and catapulting it into 2020 with these remixes, you know. But I think our head was in the right space and we have created some radio edits, you know, that didn't exist at the time because it was just live, you know, you didn't edit somebody rhyming on a mic. So Anyway, I'll talk for a lot. Yeah. I'm sorry, Shreds. Let me give you space to respond.
I don't completely know how to answer that question, other than in the 90s, I think I was a role model just because of how I conducted myself, right? Yeah. I don't think that I ever really, sure, like, did I code switch? Absolutely. When I was on the radio, you know, with Bob and Sear and Benji and like, and everybody, yeah, like, sure, there's a hip hop is a coded language that even white people in hip hop are going to adopt. But with that being said, I never tried to front like I was anybody that I wasn't. And I think that's something that really resonated with listeners and kind of engendered a kind of respect from, you know, from really everybody. And that's why I could go to a Queensbridge and no one was going to step to me, because I wasn't acting like a tough guy. I wasn't acting like I grew up in a black neighborhood. You know what I mean? Like I never had those airs that some people, some white people in hip hop might have, right? I was comfortable in my own skin. I was comfortable being like the skinny, nerdy white guy with like a really bad haircut and often really bad glasses. That was fine. I was so about the music that nothing else, you know, really mattered. I think my own kind of awakening really has taken place in a much more intense way. I think partially because of how in our faces problems in our society are via social media, but also since moving to Bed-Stuy, since being in a traditionally black neighborhood has really provided a lot of food for thought. And, you know, I came out into this neighborhood really looking for more space for the buck, right? I lived in Manhattan my whole life. And I came out here and I wasn't sure about moving to Brooklyn. My mother, she's a lovely Polish woman, said there's an expression from where she comes from, which is never move to the other side of the river. So I kept that in mind when I moved to Brooklyn. And really, I was hyper self-aware of feeling like I was part of a gentrification movement coming out here. Mm. And that I didn't like that. I didn't really know how to deal with that, because I think, you know, I know who I am and I know what I mean to a lot of people, but walking down the street, you might not know who I am. And even the fact of who I am, you know, in hip hop culture, that doesn't really mean anything when it comes to the bigger conversations around the economics and racial aspects of gentrification, right? That doesn't, I don't get a pass for that. But number one, what I found was I fell in love with this community. I love being here. Just as important, the amount of love that I've been shown in this community has been inspiring and very moving. You know, I get recognized out here a lot. I get, you know, I met Bob. We had lunch today around the corner. And I don't know if you saw this, Bob, but when we hit the corner, a dude in a big SUV was screaming my name in the car as he drove by. I get that a lot. I get that from the group of gentlemen that hang out across the street, whether it's 8 degrees or 80 degrees, and they range in age from 35 to 70. And the first day I was here, they called my name and I went across the street and I've been talking to them every day since then. I've had 3 block parties this summer. The last one became a fundraiser and speaking opportunity for Chi Osei, who's Reggie Osei, Combat Jack's son, who's running for city council in the 36th. It was such a, it was an honor to be able to provide a platform for him in that way. And to really carry on the name of Reggie Osei and honor him. And I'm trying to do more of this. I also know that, you know, my role as a white person that has occupied a lot of space in black communities it's incumbent upon me to speak to other white people. And I've been having those conversations, even in my own family. They're not always fun conversations. They're not always productive conversations, but they're necessary conversations. And trying to find that right tone where I'm not coming across as like preachy or like better than somebody because I've had the privilege of having a prominent role in hip hop culture and in an aspect of Black culture. And that's part of the conversation. I always say, like, look, like the last 2 years, particularly this year, has been incredibly illuminating. There's a whole new lexicon around racial justice that requires work. It requires taking in knowledge and processing and thinking about it and relating it to your own experiences and really checking yourself. And I try to do as much of that work as possible, because I don't really feel like you can have other important conversations until this conversation is really addressed, right? You can't.
What is wrong?
It's just fundamental to addressing everything moving forward. And I'm just trying to do my part. And I wouldn't even call myself an activist by any means, but I think I'm trying to use my voice in a way that makes sense, that pushes things forward. And that acknowledges the thanks I feel for what I've been given by so many people.
Yeah, Bobito, I love saying your name.
I gotta give y'all praise, because me and Shesh have never done an interview for 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
Never. This is the longest fucking interview we have. This is the longest interview I've ever done, and I'm completely engaged.
I love it.
So thank you, because y'all are asking us a lot of questions that most people don't ask us or haven't thought to ask us or were too scared to ask us. So no good doubt. Stuff, Jasmine and Talib.
What we try to do with People's Part, I want to accept the compliment that you gave us graciously, because as Stretch just mentioned, Combat Jack, Reggie Osei, I grew up in New York City watching Gil Noble. You know, I grew up, I'm born in the 70s. I remember This Is Your Life, you know, and so mm-hmm. I try to do deep dives, and I'm trying to do like, which I'm trying to present in a way where the show could be looked at as what Gil Noble did with Like It Is on ABC for so many years,
mm-hmm,
or what
mm-hmm,
Combat mm-hmm. Jack did, rest in peace, with Reggie Osei did with the Combat Jack show. So, you know, for you to say that, and we only have a couple more questions. I think we might have two more left. So you got right to the I appreciate the love, brother. And it's like, I'm glad I sat down. It was a challenge for us to figure out how to frame, because really, with all due respect, we could have did this with each one of y'all. We could have did a whole Stretch show, a whole Bob show, and God willing, maybe we'll do that in the future. But it's my honor, my pleasure to sit down with y'all. Jasmine ask her question.
But Taleb, it speaking for me, it means a lot to be here. And when I bumped into you at Dave Chappelle, jump off at Vans, you showed me so much love outside, and we hadn't seen each other in a long time. And that meant a lot to me, because particularly how you have grown and evolved as a thinker, as an activist, like particularly because of that, the love that you showed me was really appreciated. You know, I love the acknowledgement for what I did musically, but I want to be respected and appreciated for what I'm doing as a human being outside of music.
Word.
Bobito, so you founded the Bounce magazine, and your documentary Rock Rubber 45s placed you right at the intersection of basketball and music. I want to talk a little bit about Ice Cube's Big Three partner being associated with Steve Bannon and Ice Cube's recent statements about Trump. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Wasn't aware of that. And I wasn't aware of his Trump comments. You know, I think doing business in this day and age and trying to avoid somewhere along the line people who do not align with your political and social justice perspectives is difficult. I think there are times when we draw the line. Stretch and I actually just went through this recently where we had a potential project and, you know, we pulled out because of some things that were said that were flammable, I guess, you know, or not completely accept. It was, you know, it's like we all kind of like draw the line, but you know, it's tough because I mean, I'll give you an example with ESPN. You know, I was hired to be a director of a series called Sneaker Center for their Plus platform. That's like their new streaming. They want to be the Netflix of sports and entertainment. I thought it was a great opportunity to, you know, to further my career as a filmmaker. You know, and so I was pumping a bunch of features, one of which was the African-American Sneaker Festival in Portland. I mean, it was like a phenomenal segment. You know, I hired like predominantly people of color on the editing staff, hired people of color, you know, to be behind a camera, cinematographers, you know, it was like really controlling everything I could control. And then, you know, ESPN saw the segment. They were like, nah, we're not going to run this. And it was like two episodes in. And I was like, what? You know, like this, you know, this is not just like about sneakers. This is about like empowerment. And, you know, and this is, you know, 2019, and I was still sensitive, you know, if it was 2020 with all the, you know, things that are going on, I would have been like on hyper mode, but I was like, y'all, I really told the executive producers like, yo, like I'm going to draw the line on this. If they don't run that segment, I'm out because that's, you know, we come from the era of the 60s, 70s and 80s. It was like, you know, no sellout and basketball or hip hop was like a big thing. Like, you know, you would, you know, in basketball, like that was like a dude on the mic, but like, oh, he sold out on, you know, on that layup. Like it was like big deal. Like, you know, it was like, oh my God, I'm a sellout in hip hop. Like, you know, so I was like, nah, I can't do this shit. And so I really had a long conversation with myself. And I was like, if I pull out, they're going to hire one of their corporate white males to direct this. Because all ESPN was sending me was white male correspondents. And I was like, nah, I want to get Maria Clifton in here, a black Puerto Rican, to be one of my correspondents. They were like, ah, oh, we don't know who she is. Eventually she wound up being like the majority of the biggest features in the show because they fell in love with her because I knew what the fuck I was talking about.
That's right.
You know, basically like I was able to slide in so many people of color into this 8-episode series that I don't think another director would have done, you know, because they would have been focused on like, oh, sneakers. Yeah. You know, like I was like more like, nah, like, I mean, same thing. If you read my book, Where'd You Get Those? New York City Sneaker Culture, 1960 to 1987. Or if you watch my film, Rock Rubber 45s, or you watch my first film, Doing It in the Park, Pick Up Basketball, NYC. Or if you realize what me and Stretch did for the 90s, you know, giving voice to the voices, like that's always been me. Like I'm going to slide in as many unknown up and coming people as I possibly can when I get these, you know, big ass platforms to give me an opportunity to shine. And so yes. I was like, damn, this sucks. But I'm not a sellout. I'm not compromising my creativity. I'm going to still.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The productions Nuit d'Afrique and TD Bang Group are proud to present a musical encounter between Africa and First Nations with Mi'kma'Africa, Jelle Tapa, and Anaknid on the stage of the Nationale, and broadcast live on Nuit d'Afrique's Facebook page, Friday, February 26th at 8 p.m. More info at productionsnuitdafrique.com.
Vous écoutez CKUT 90.3 à Montréal.
Ok, oh, merci beaucoup.
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 24 days into the month of February. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You're tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's episode, an episode of the Alberta Advantage podcast titled Expand Medicare to Include Dental Care. All that plus your weekly music picks right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancheckut.